Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. And today is the day that the 113th Congress will convene. It will happen a couple hours from now at the constitutionally required time of noon Eastern Time. And there will be some interesting things happening. The makeup of the Congress is rather historic. First female delegation from the state of New Hampshire, for fewest number of military veterans in the Senate and the House. The makeup of Congress, this Congress, has not been this volatile in some 20 years because of different political tides and also redistricting. The 112th Congress went out with, well, a whimper, probably. And with not a whole lot of support, the recent polls show that something like anywhere between 80 and 95% of Americans think that lawmakers are doing a lousy job. And some suggest that perhaps the other percentage are members of Congress themselves, along with their staffs and their families. So what will be considered? How do we avert the fiscal cliff? What about spending cuts? What about a number of issues? Gun control? What about the Violence Against Women Act, which died without a vote in the House? Jason Roberts is our guest this hour, associate professor of political science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, previously was at the University of Minnesota. His research centers on American political institutions with a focus on legislative voting and parliamentary procedure in the U.S. Congress. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. What are your hopes for this Congress? Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Jason Roberts, hello.
Hello.
Why don't we start with what's going to happen just a couple hours from now with the swearing in of the 113th Congress? Are there any personalities that you're particularly looking forward to following in this Congress?
Well, as you mentioned, there are many new members. Probably the most interesting thing to happen today will be the vote for Speaker and to see if any of the unrest that Speaker Boehner has dealt with in the closing days of the 112th Congress carry over into that vote for Speaker today. That is typically the first vote that's one of the first votes that's cast. So it will be interesting to see if there are any Republican defections from his coalition.
Do you think there will be? There was a lot of talk about that yesterday, but today it seems to be those who were expressing opposition seem to be wavering a bit.
Well, it's a risky thing for them to do. If you vote against the Speaker and you're not successful in deposing him, there can be consequences for that, such as, you know, losing committee seats. Mm. Or you might find that bills that you are sponsoring or favor strongly don't see the light of day in the new Congress.
Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people who were pretty critical of him yesterday. Governor Chris Christie really lit into him for this not giving money to victims of Hurricane Sandy. What's going on with that? Why did Congress not deal with that before Friday of this week?
It's a very unusual situation. As members on both sides pointed out yesterday, it's typically routine to authorize emergency spending with a national disaster such as Hurricane Sandy. It's still unclear exactly why Speaker Boehner decided to pull the bill. Apparently, there had been an agreement with Eric Cantor, the majority leader, and other leaders that there would be a vote before the end of the Congress on this spending package. But late in the night of the night they voted on the fiscal cliff, Speaker Boehner decided not to have the vote. There's been some speculation that the fiscal cliff was such a tough vote for members who were against more government spending that then turning around and making them vote on a bill to spend more money for disaster relief was going to be a bridge too far for some members.
Mm-hmm.
It's been very unusual. It's been a long time since you've seen Republicans so upset with one another, at least in public.
Yeah. And tell me about the spending issue now. The Congress dealt with tax cuts, but they didn't really deal with spending reductions very thoroughly. When do they have to do that, and how will they do that?
Well, it's still a bit unclear. In the last Congress, they were unable to come up with a long-term spending agreement, so they created this thing called a sequester, which became part of the fiscal cliff. The idea was that they would set up a list of spending cuts to military and domestic spending that were so undesirable to all members that they would force themselves to have a deal by the end of the year. They did not get a deal by the end of the year. They punted that down the road for two more months. So we now have 2 months until there will be another deadline on this. I'm sure there will be some negotiations to see if they can come up with a deal on this, but there's nothing to prevent them from kicking the can down the road again, which at this point, the way that things have been going lately, that's probably the safest bet.
Do you imagine that the makeup of the new Congress, I'm wondering if there are enough changes that there will be more of a spirit of let's work together?
It's hard to say at this point. I mean, there has not been a big change in the House. There aren't that many new members, and the partisan breakdown is very similar. The Democrats have a few more seats than they had before, but not enough to really shift the balance of power. The Senate is a bit more Democratic, and you do have some new members there, but you lost some members who were more moderate, and the Republicans who are still in the Senate minority have the 40 votes they need to filibuster anything and block progress block bills if they choose to do so. So it's unclear that the new makeup of the Congress will have a big effect on productivity.
What about members of the Tea Party, Jason? Has the Congress lost many members of the Tea Party, or are they still strong?
Not many. There's still a little more than 50, I believe, who are part of that caucus. And in some ways, that's part of the problem that Speaker Boehner is having now. He has a very divided caucus on some issues related to government spending.
Mm-hmm.
And the 50-member caucus is not really enough to do anything on their own, but they are strong enough to block things. If they don't want to vote for something that the Speaker would like to do, then he doesn't have the votes to do it.
What about these percentages that show that the American public really thinks Congress is doing a terrible job? Do members of Congress pay attention to those polls? Are they concerned about them? And why do so many people think that Congress is doing a terrible job?
Well, there's a number of reasons why this is true. I mean, unlike some of the other institutions, such as the Supreme Court, for instance, Congress does all its work out in the public. And the Supreme Court has disagreements just like members of Congress do, but they don't hold competing press conferences and they don't scream at each other on the floor of the House and Senate like members of Congress do. Part of it is people are getting what they ask for. You know, they're electing people who say they're going to fight for their districts and take care of their individual interests, and then when you mix all that together, you don't always get progress in the same direction. And so in many ways, the American people are getting what they ask for when they continue to elect these people who then do exactly what they ask them to do, take care of their district, take care of their state, not compromise, stick to their positions, and this is what you get.
Do you have higher hopes for the 113th Congress than you did for the 112th?
I think it could be a little better. The 112th Congress was dominated by the 2012 presidential election. Minority Leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, said early on in the Congress that his number one goal in the 112th Congress was to make President Obama a one-term president. Well, that didn't work out. We've had the election. They know they're going to be dealing with the president for the next 4 years. So hopefully there won't be as much electoral politics creeping into everything that's going on as we saw last time.
We have a number of people who would like to speak to the issue, so we'll start taking phone calls. Here's how you join our conversation, 800-486-8655. The 113th Congress will be sworn in today at noon Eastern Time. We need to talk about the significant piece of legislation that Senator Dianne Feinstein has said she will introduce today. I don't know if it will be today, but we'll talk about a ban on assault weapons. Legislation she said she's been working on for about a year. We'll also look at spending reductions. We'll look at how the 112th Congress ended their term and whether or not you feel that compromise was made here in keeping us from going over the fiscal cliff. Did they finally work together? What hopes do you have and what issues do you want the 113th Congress to take on? 800-486-8655, the number. Jim in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. What I'd like to talk about today is that I unless there's a much greater effort by the progressive wing of the Democratic Party on an ongoing basis, I think we're going to see more of the same, because the pattern is well established. And to draw an analogy, in domestic abuse, you don't nothing changes unless the person gets treatment. And in this situation, the treatment that's needed is to give education, to nominate progressive people, and then support them with money and time over a period of time, especially in the rural areas which have been gerrymandered in favor of the Republicans. And looking historically, look at the tobacco lobby and the people that are promoting fire retardant products, both of these things which caused serious health consequences for people. The companies propagandized to continue their practices. They hire shill scientists who put out, quotes, facts that support their position. They give money to candidates to perpetuate themselves in office, and or in their positions, I should say. And then at the end, when all is said and done, they continue to turn out the harmful products, and say that any attempt to regulate them is impinging on their freedom.
Professor Roberts,
you know, it's hard to say what we're going to see different. As the caller points out, it's not so much the redistricting that has created the situation, but the population patterns in this country are now such that you see a lot more Democratic constituents living in urban areas. And what that produces is a number of districts where they win with large margins. If you actually look at the 2012 vote, there were more votes for Democratic House members than Republican House members. But the way those voters are distributed has led to a situation where Republicans can win a narrow majority of House seats without winning a majority of the nationwide votes. And that's as much about population distribution as it is redistricting. You really can't do a lot about inner-city areas that are you know, 95, 98% Democratic.
Let's look at if we can do this. I don't know if we can or not. He talked about progressive members of the House and the Senate. Is there a breakdown of how many members of the Senate and the House would be considered progressive, how many would be considered conservative, how many are moderate Democrats, how many are moderate Republicans, et cetera?
Well, it's hard to make those clean definitions. Some people would interpret those words differently. We have seen, though, a gradual reduction in the number of moderates from both parties that have been showing up. A number of things are going on. The first is Republicans have, and through the primary process, gotten rid of a lot of their moderate members. Senator Lugar, for instance, was primaried in 2012. And you've also seen a number of moderates who have grown frustrated with the increasing polarization of both the House and Senate and simply decided to go do something else. Olympia Snowe from Maine being a prime example of someone who just decided to retire rather than continue working in the Congress. But if you look at objective measures such as the number of blue dog Democrats, and these are conservative Democrats, they're at an all-time low. And part of this is the population patterns I mentioned. Part of it is that we are continuing to see a sorting of American people where people who are conservative now vote Republican, people who are more moderate, I mean more progressive or liberal, vote Democrat consistently both at the presidential and congressional level.
Jim, thanks for your call. Let's go to Pat in Richland County. Hi, Pat.
Well, Jim was, first caller was pretty well on the mark here. You know, the rich are going to get their way. Everybody knows that because the Congress is so beholden to them. Witness the election you were just talking about. So all this talk of the cliff stuff, the cliff and the disaster and all that, ask your guest, I want to know, don't you think this is just a lot of posturing for the masses to prepare everybody for this big cutback that's going to come to the social programs? Because, after all, it takes a lot of money to run an empire, you know, a couple hundred countries with troops in them and stuff like that.
Oh, the cliff certainly was a manufactured crisis, so to speak. The tax cuts were expiring. They could have been dealt with at any time. The sequester, the unpleasant spending cuts that were set to take effect automatically, that was through a bill passed by Congress. So this was, in many ways, a false crisis. And what it has done is, as the caller points out, is kicked the can down the road in terms of dealing with the long-term issue of how we get our spending and revenue on board. We're now at a point in American history where we're taking in an incredibly low percentage of taxes as a proportion of the gross domestic product. And we have an aging population. The baby boomers are beginning to retire. And so we have this bulge in the population of people who are going to be going on to the rolls of Social Security and Medicare at the same time that we're at an all-time low in tax revenue. And those things just are not going to mesh well in the long run.
What did you think of the deal that was finally reached? Is it fair? Does it put a burden pretty much equally on everybody or not?
Well, again, fairness would be in the eye of the beholder.
It does
raise marginal tax rates on some high-income individuals, which is something the president had campaigned on and I think was an issue he was going to insist upon. One thing that hasn't gotten as much attention out of this deal is it did allow the 2% payroll tax reduction to expire, and that was a temporary stimulus measure that had been implemented earlier on. And so, you know, if you just read the headlines, you might think, well, if I don't make $400,000 a year, this is all good for me, and that's not true. I think, you know, anyone who's earning income is going to see their payroll tax go up in the coming year.
It's going to be, from what I've been reading, about $1,000 per person, isn't it?
Well, it depends on the income level. The payroll tax is about 6.5% of a person's paycheck on income up to $113,000. So, depending on what you make, you can do the math. You're going to see a 2% increase in that up to $113,000.
Mm-hmm. And what about down the road? You keep hearing Social Security is in trouble, Medicare is in trouble. Would you agree that those programs are both in trouble? Is one in trouble more than the other? And will there be fights during this session of Congress about changing Social Security, changing Medicare?
Well, they both have a long-term structural deficit, but their deficits are quite different. Social Security is actually not in nearly as bad a shape as Medicare is. Long-run projections on Social Security show us having, you know, under current tax levels, about 75% of our commitments into the future. You can make a few small changes to that program and make it viable. Medicare is the bigger issue. It's projected to double or triple in the coming decades as a percentage of the gross domestic product. We're seeing people live longer. We're seeing healthcare costs increase at a much higher rate than inflation. And that's the program that is most threatening to the future fiscal health of the country. Most of the talk in the past Congress was about making it a slight change in the Social Security formula, something called the chained CPI, which is the way the government calculates inflation for recipients of Social Security. We know that that's calculated a bit too highly right now based on how people spend money, so you could make that change and that would reduce some of those costs. But Medicare is a much more difficult problem. You can talk about cutting payments to doctors and hospitals, but when you do that, you end up with fewer doctors and hospitals participating in the program. And, you know, Medicare and Social Security are both programs that have strong bipartisan support throughout the country, so it's going to be very difficult to make long-term changes to those programs when you have members who are elected to 2- and 6-year terms. They simply don't have the incentives to fix a problem that's 30 years down the road when they're up for re-election every 2 years.
What happened with that cut for doctors in the Medicare program? Was that taken care of?
Well, that's a prime example of what I'm talking about. Congress has passed a law to reduce the amount of money that goes to Medicare doctors. And then every year this cut is scheduled to take effect. I think this year it would have been about a 27% cut. And every year Congress passes what's known as the Medicare doc fix. They say, okay, never mind, we're not going to do that after all.
Mm-hmm.
And they put it off for another year. And they continue to kick that can down the road, and we never see changes. Now, it's unclear whether that's something that would be a good thing to happen or not. It certainly would not be beneficial to Medicare recipients if their current doctors chose to no longer participate in the program. But if you continue putting off that spending cut, tomorrow never comes, so to speak.
Jason Roberts is our guest this hour. We're talking about the 113th Congress. Well, we don't have a lot to say about them yet, other than who they are and what they're likely to take up early in the game, what they have to take up. We're just ending the 112th Congress late yesterday. And a lot of people were pretty upset that they couldn't get along, that they didn't do very much. So what about the 113th Congress? We're looking at all of that this hour of the program. Jason Roberts is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And you can always leave messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Second hour of our program, this book has been receiving rave reviews. It is absolutely absorbing. Andrew Solomon's book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew spent 10 years interviewing families who were raising children who were prodigies, who were dwarfs, who had severe physical disabilities or mental disabilities, parents who had children who were criminals. It's a fascinating book, and he will be with us hour two of our show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. An email that's come in, Professor Roberts, from Nuna. We who are older were discussing the deficit. It seems to us that job creation has been a great way to reduce the deficit, but we're hearing very little about this.
Certainly, yeah. If we had higher employment throughout the country, that would increase tax revenue, which would help the budget situation. It has been difficult for Democrats and Republicans to find ways to agree on how to create jobs. Republicans tend to believe that if you cut taxes further, this will incentivize employers to hire more employees. Democrats tend to want to and add new infrastructure projects, rebuild roads, bridges, light rail trains, you name it, and that those kinds of programs would stimulate hiring by giving out those contracts. And so there's not much middle ground between those two. One requires you to cut taxes. One requires you to ultimately raise taxes and spend more money to build things.
Jack in Eagle River, hi.
Yeah, hi. One of the penalties of calling in a little early is as you wait, you change. My apologies to the screener, but I have two quick comments. Number one has to do with Social Security. You don't hear much about raising or eliminating the cap, which would seem to be an extremely simple way of solving the problem, at least for some distance ahead. And secondly, when I go to the doctor, say, once a year for a checkup, the bill comes in at, say, $140, and then under it says Medicare approves $68, something like that. And I always wonder, do they anticipate what Medicare will approve and therefore they pad their costs to begin with, or how does that come about?
Well, in the Social Security question, the caller's right. We, as I mentioned earlier, we currently cap the payroll tax at about the first $113,000 of income. That's indexed to inflation, so it changes a bit every year. And certainly if you raise that cap, people who make above that would see their payroll tax go up, and that would create more funding for the program. It would create a higher tax burden for people who make that amount of money. With respect to Medicare, I'm not an expert on Medicare billing, but there certainly is an incentive for healthcare providers to charge the amount that Medicare will pay for a device or a service. I mean, anecdotally, I've known people in the past who sell devices, and they say, well, I said, how much does your device cost? And they say, well, it costs what Medicare pays for it. That's what it costs. So there is certainly something to that. But in general, Medicare is quite efficient at holding down costs compared to what you see with private insurers.
And what about this raising the cap? Would that be a huge battle to do that, or does it seem logical to most members of Congress to do that?
Well, whether it's logical or whether it be a battle are two different.
Right.
As we just saw over the fight over marginal rates, there's a large number of members of Congress, and Democrats and Republicans, who do look out for individuals who have higher incomes. These are people who primarily fund their campaigns, and these people are highly influential. So to do that would certainly be a fight. I haven't heard a lot of talk about people wanting to go down that path, but it's certainly something that could help in the future.
We have a couple lines open. If you'd like to join our conversation on the Ideas Network, Jason Roberts is our guest this hour, Associate Professor of Political Science, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We're talking about the 113th Congress, which will be sworn in today at noon, and we're also looking at the 112th Congress. All the fiscal issues, the tax issues, the spending issues, the debt issues, gun control issues, and more. What would you like to have them take up? What successes are you hoping for? What frustrates you about what hasn't been done? 800-486-8655 is our number. Scott in La Crosse, hi.
Happy political new year.
Thank you, Scott. You
here
too.
Here we go again. Huh?
Here we go again.
What I would like to do is take your guest back to what he opened the program with, which was the danger in taking on a Speaker of the House and as a challenge to Boehner, saying that Boehner has power, and that I guess he said that committee appointments and making sure that your legislation goes through. And yet earlier today on Morning Edition, one of their analysts was saying that taking away the earmarks carrot that they used to offer to get the members in line had really diminished the ability that Boehner had to deal with these folks. So what I guess I would like to you to just give me your best analysis is the issue here Boehner? How good a speaker do you really think Boehner is? And is it really the earmarks, or is it just that he's not doing the kind of corralling that other people have been able to do in the past?
I mean, the caller is right. The earmark ban that went into effect a good while back has made it more difficult for leaders to grease the skids, so to speak, to get some things pushed through. Now, as to the quality of Boehner himself, I think it's often hard to evaluate them independent of the situation they're dealing with. Boehner has a very narrow majority, and he has a big part of his caucus, you know, more than 50 members who are Tea Party members. It's unclear whether those people would even respond to earmarks when a big part of what they ran on was cutting government spending and not having this kind of pork barrel project that we've talked about in the past.
Who's been more effective, Pelosi or Boehner?
Well, it's easier to be in the minority if you're Pelosi, right? It's she's not in charge of getting anything done, so it's easy to sit back and throw bombs at the other side, and that's, you know, the Republicans were quite good at that when they were in the minority, and both sides have really perfected this kind of procedural warfare. But I think, you know, Boehner has a very tough job trying to deal with a disparate caucus. He's, as the caller pointed out, he's lost some of his carrots, and he's used his sticks. I mean, he did remove a couple people from their committee assignments for the upcoming Congress. That did not go over well with these individuals, but those kinds of things do tend to help facilitate cooperation in the future.
Mm-hmm. What about when Pelosi was head of the majority? Did she have a less obstreperous membership to deal with, do you think, or not?
No, typically the Democrats are a more divided caucus than the Republicans. Democrats tend to believe in having a multitude of perspectives, and she had a lot of difficult members to deal with. It's unusual that Boehner has this issue. For the past decade or so, the Republicans have typically been the more unified of the two caucuses. When Denny Hastert was Speaker, for instance, there were very few instances of where he would put a bill on the floor and not be able to corral the votes for it. And we've seen several times where Speaker Boehner's had to pull a bill with it, and we couldn't get the votes. We saw it just a week or so ago with his so-called Plan B dealing with the fiscal cliff. He presented something to his caucus, and they simply wouldn't support it. So having a divided caucus makes being a leader very difficult, especially in an overall polarized environment.
Mm-hmm, I imagine. Scott, thank you, as always, for your call. Happy New Year. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I think what we're experiencing is something that hasn't been experienced in this country in over 100 years. We're going through the transition of the demise of a major political party. The Republican Party, by 2020, will be just a splinter of what it exists today. The white, older class, middle class, whatever is left of it, is dying, is becoming a minority. If you really want to listen to someone who really seems to have a clue as to what is going on, this Congress will be no better than the last, and for many people, it'll be worse. But you listen to the New York Times and Paul Krugman, he's been right on the money for the last 4, 6, 8 years. And the Republican Party, as we know it, the Walkers and the rest of them, they are a dying breed. I compare them to what I think it was General Sheridan looked at the American West after the 1865 Civil War and looked at the American Indian and said, the only good Indian's a dead Indian.
Professor Roberts.
The caller it hits on an important point. If you look at the election statistics and the census data, Republicans are seeing the type of voter who tends to vote for them, typically white men is their biggest constituency, and that is increasingly becoming a smaller portion of the electorate. And we're seeing growth in significant number of Hispanic voters and African American voters, and these are our voters at this time who have not been supportive of the Republican Party. It's probably too early to predict the demise of the Republican Party. They can always make changes and appeal to groups, but you do see some people in the party, Jeb Bush, for instance, saying that it's imperative that the party reach out to people who are not older white men if they're going to succeed in the future.
And on what issues will they do that? Will it be immigration? Will it be something we haven't thought of?
Immigration is a good example. There is some movement in both parties to see comprehensive immigration reform in the new Congress. It's not an issue that fits neatly along the left-right divide that we see so many issues line up across. Many Republicans who are business owners, for instance, would love to see the ability to hire new workers and have immigration. Some Democrats feel threatened by that, but at the same time you see some Republicans who are staunchly opposed to allowing more immigration, and many Democrats are for it. So it's a splitting issue, and it's unclear what kind of reform would be possible. But that is an area where Republicans could potentially make inroads with Hispanic voters.
Mm-hmm. Mike, thank you very much for your call. Ahmed in Menominee. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Since your guest is a political science professor, I'm wondering if he had anything to say about electoral reform. You know, changing the way we vote members of Congress to make it function better.
You know, as I mentioned earlier on, we in many ways get the Congress we ask for. When we vote in small districts every 2 years, you end up getting people who care about the short term and over a small area. There hasn't been a lot of talk about major reforms. Some Tea Party members were actually in favor of repealing the 17th Amendment, which created the direct election of the U.S. Senate, but that's not an idea that has gotten very far. I think you could see something where longer terms for House members might help create incentives for people to deal with long-term problems, but I don't see anything on the horizon with that regard.
They must be. It's a really, 2 years goes by so quickly, doesn't it? They must, and I've heard members of Congress say this, no sooner do you get elected, then you're on the phone trying to raise money for the next election. And considering how much money it takes now, I'm sure that the pressure getting on the phone yesterday rather than today is pretty great.
No, I'm sure you're exactly right. You'll see members, after they're sworn in today, will probably go across the street and sit down and start making phone calls to plan for re-election.
Mm.
Sounds very unpleasant to me.
Yeah, it does. Ahmed, thanks for your call. Mike in Oshkosh. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi, Kathleen. Happy New Year.
To you, too.
I think what's happening is there's a paradigm shift, and in deference to Mike from Appleton, who thinks it's one party who has to change, I think both parties are recognizing they have to change. For decades now, both parties have been manipulating the public, an ignorant public, I would argue, who thinks that we can live on a credit card, not pay the bills, and address the economic issues we have through fraud, waste, and abuse. The fact is, the average retiree gets $500,000 more in benefits, both Social Security and Medicare, than they ever pay in. So this notion that's been perpetuated of late, that they're just getting their money back, is so grossly inaccurate. What's going to happen is Republicans have to raise taxes, and they've been brought to the table. They are recognizing they're going to do that. The next part of the solution is addressing entitlement. We've got 10,000 baby boomers retiring each day for 20 years in a row, and at $500,000 a piece, we're talking like $70 trillion of unfunded liabilities. So this notion that Democrats have that you can leave entitlements off the table is simply impossible, impossible. And I wonder what the guest thinks of that.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike.
The caller has a good point there. We do have two parties, the Democrats who don't want to make major structural changes to entitlement programs, and you have a Republican Party that's philosophically opposed to tax increases. I think if you're someone like me and you look at the numbers on this, you see that both those positions are unreasonable in the long run, given the demographic boom we're looking at. Baby boomers are retiring. We have a smaller ratio of workers to recipients of entitlement benefits than has ever been the case. just something I talk to my students about. You know, it's you see, and they ask why this is true, and well, older Americans tend to vote at higher levels than do younger Americans typically, and so you know, I kid with my students. I'm trying to create some generational warfare in them and point out to them that, you know, that they're going to end up getting the left holding the bag on this. But it is a real issue that's going to have to be addressed in the future.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Donald in Madison. Hi, Donald.
Hi. Good morning to you both. I was wondering if I could just have the guest comment on the president's role in this whole thing in terms of getting things done in Congress, their effectiveness. I know recently we heard Republicans saying that Obama, you know, was off cheerleading when he should have been, you know, getting Congress to work together and get things done. And I just wonder if there's any truth to that and, you know, how is Obama doing and maybe a historical perspective on that, too, in terms of that relationship.
Mm,
all right. I'll take my comments on that.
Yeah, there, good question. Thanks, Donald.
Well, the president has, you know, gets a lot of attention on this issue, but has very little direct influence on the process. I mean, the president can't even introduce legislation. He can veto things that come to his desk, and he can certainly go on TV and go on the airwaves and try to prod members to do things, but his formal tools are quite limited. And you see both parties have criticized his approach. Many liberal Democrats think they can't trust him in negotiations, that he's given away way too many things in negotiations with Republicans. And Republicans think that they can't trust him either, that he'll say one thing, but then he always tries to preserve what the liberals want. So it's a tough position for him to be in. It's I often say, for college football fans out there, it's like the quarterback theory. The president gets probably way too much credit when things are going well and way too much blame when things are going poorly, given the amount of control they actually have over the process.
I didn't understand fully, maybe you can explain this to us, why Joe Biden was called in by McConnell, why the president was kind of cast aside.
Well, it's unusual in that I think the personal relationships between the leaders are probably at an all-time low. Many of your guests may have seen the Politico story earlier this week that there was a White House meeting last week, Speaker Boehner and Harry Reid exchanged some words that wouldn't be allowed to be said on the air. And so there's just been a breakdown in personal relationships and a breakdown in trust. And with Vice President Biden having spent so much time in the Senate, he knows Senator McConnell quite well, and they were able to make a deal in a way that the others were not able to do, given the personal animosity between them.
Mm-hmm. Bud in Sturgeon Bay. Hi.
Hi, Kathy. Good morning.
Hi.
The problem, as it appears to me to be, is the fact that the congressmen are so beholden to all of their donors that they can't really discuss the major issues. I look on the revenue side of our current economic problems, and I see things like a farm bill that supports the price of milk. Now, I live in Wisconsin. I mean, you can't throw a rock out your window without hitting a cow. There's no reason that the government should be supporting the price of milk. We ought to let some of these farmers that are, well, dependent upon that system go away. And then secondarily, the oil companies. Why are we still subsidizing oil companies when each and every one of them make billions per quarter? And thirdly, the Congress seems unable, because of their, oh, I don't know, dependence on their donors, to discuss some of the real issues. For example, the reason the jobs have left this country, and I'm an old machinist, and I'm just a worker guy. The reason that jobs left this country is we've allowed corporations to chase cheap labor across the globe. What we ought to do is start instituting some trade barriers. If a company decides that it wants to expatriate itself and go to China and manufacture goods, fine. They should not be allowed to import their goods back here to the United States. We need to start making this stuff ourselves.
Jason Roberts.
Yeah, these are complicated issues. The caller's right that we have seen some companies have outsourced some labor. This has been a part of the free trade movement that you know, most economists, whether they're liberal or conservative in their general leanings, would say that free trade in the long run helps all of us. But in terms of lower prices for goods that we purchase, however, it does create short-term disruptions for people who are in those jobs. With respect to things, you know, the concentrated interest, the dairy interest, the oil interest, this is a common theme in American politics. You know, the groups that are most affected by an issue tend to be the loudest on that issue, and they tend to get their way. People who purchase milk there's a lot of us, but we're not as well organized as people who produce milk, and so it's much more difficult for our interests to be heard.
Thank you very much, Bud, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the 113th Congress, which will be sworn in today at 12 o'clock noon Eastern Time to analyze the makeup of the Congress and what will be on their agenda. Jason Roberts, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. More phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Roberts, Senator Feinstein had said that she will introduce updated assault weapons legislation in the new Congress, and that would happen today. Will that happen today? And will there be some kind of bipartisan agreement that we need to make the country safer?
Well, I think Senator Feinstein certainly is within her rights to introduce that bill today. The assault weapons ban was originally introduced in the mid-90s, and that legislation was allowed to expire in 2004. It's still unclear how effective that law actually was, in that it exempted a number of things that could be considered assault weapons, and it was easily worked around by people who wanted to purchase those. It's certainly, though, the case that the tragedy in Connecticut has reignited this issue for many people in the country. The president appointed a task force led by Vice President Biden to make recommendations to him, and the president has indicated that he will push very hard for new gun control legislation. In the days after in the aftermath of the shooting, I think people who were supporting gun control were optimistic. It's unclear if that kind of we'll see the kind of bipartisan support you'll need in the new year once, you know, people such as the NRA get active on the issue. There are a lot of people who feel strongly that you don't solve these issues by regulating guns more, and many people see it the other way. So we'll see what the vice president comes up with and how hard the Democrats push for this kind of legislation.
And what about the commission that's been put together? Have they completed their work? Do they have a deadline for completing their
work? They do have a deadline, and I don't know the exact date of it, but they have not completed their work as of yet. I do think it's in January, though, and the president intends to make a big push for this in a State of the Union address.
Yes. Carl in Madison, hi.
Did you say Carl?
Yeah, I said Carl. Hi, Carl.
Hi. Kathleen, I will let Jason to address the following two questions. Number one, regarding gerrymandering, California and four or five other, maybe six states, are in the process of getting rid of gerrymandering. They've gone to different ways of reapportioning districts. I'm wondering what Jason thinks the future of that effort is. Second of all, in the middle late 1980s, W.R. Grace headed a commission to cut corporate welfare and identified $300 billion egregious giveaways to corporations. Nothing has been done with it, and I'll bet you that's closer to $600 billion now.
The gerrymandering issue is one that, as a political scientist, we find a little frustrating. The media have latched on to gerrymandering as the cause of all of our problems, and that's true to an extent, but it's much more limited than the mass media would have us believe. If you look at the U.S. Senate, it hasn't been redistricted since we split North and South Dakota, and we see the same level of polarization there that we've seen in the House. Part of the issue with districts is just where people have chosen to live. You have 650,000, 700,000 people in a district, and you start drawing districts in an urban area. Those districts are going to be heavily Democratic. You start drawing districts in a rural area of the South; those are going to be heavily Republican districts. There's just not a lot you can do about that. With respect to corporate welfare, yeah, there are a number of things in the tax code that do benefit corporations. These are complicated issues. It's easy for someone to say this is a corporate giveaway, and then the corporation will come back and say, but, yeah, we're providing jobs to people. If we don't get these breaks, we'll have to lay people off, and then it'll create an employment problem. So there's no easy answer on those issues.
Thank you, Carl. Hugh in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. I want to disagree with you and the earlier callers about the future of the Republicans. It seems to me if the Republicans want to survive as a party, they have to stand for equal rights, including equal rights for white people. Including equal rights for men. You were talking about the domestic violence against women act. This is wrong. If there's violence against anybody, that should be a crime, not just against this group or that group. Immigration. When many of these illegals become, get an amnesty, they will have a preferential right because of affirmative action to admission to university, to jobs, to promotions, and so forth. What the Republicans have done is forgotten the white people in their party. They have not stood up. When President Obama talks about, we should all play by the same rules, that is the last thing Obama and the Democrats want. They want special rules for this group and that group. When the Republicans begin to stand up for equal rights for everybody, including whites, including men, then perhaps they can win an election. And trying to win the illegal vote or this vote or that vote, I think is a disaster. It will be the end of the Republican Party. We had another Dewey who lost with Romney. We have to get a conservative Republican to win the Republican vote and win the American vote.
Jason.
With respect to the Violence Against Women Act, I know we talked about that not being reauthorized earlier. Some of the Republican objections were along the lines of what the caller mentions. The reauthorization of the bill included new protections for LGBT individuals and undocumented immigrants, and that did cause some rifts in the Republican Party, and that's the primary reason why we did not see reauthorization of that.
I have a hard time believing the Republican Party is going to experience a resurgence if they classify themselves as being the party that stands up for white people.
Well, I don't think they would ever be that, say that in an explicit way. As many Republicans have pointed out, there's no reason to expect that new immigrants who happen to be of Hispanic origin are predisposed to be Democrats. I mean, these are tend to be often religiously conservative individuals who many own businesses. The typical Republican message of low taxes and pro-business is something that could end up appealing to a number of Hispanic voters. So there's no reason why the Republicans should not try to compete for the Hispanic vote.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, they've been limiting themselves with their policies on immigration, and a number of them voted against. When Sonia Sotomayor, when she was placed on the Supreme Court, and just a number of what you'd call self-inflicted wounds that they've inflicted on themselves with the Hispanic community that have limited their ability to earn votes there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Hugh, for the call. Tom in Waukon, Iowa. Hi.
Hi. Yesterday I heard two New England politicians basically say the red states are not going to be, can't veto aid to the blue states because they didn't like the results of the election. And it brought back the 50s to me when it was the South versus the North on civil rights, et cetera, et cetera. And have we really only gotten about 10 years past the Civil War and could this thing start to collapse is my question to the political scientist.
All right, we have about 45 seconds.
Well, it is interesting to see that, as I mentioned at the outset, this kind of Sandy relief like that we're proposing for Hurricane Sandy has typically been routine. It is interesting to note, though, that the number of congressional Republicans from the Northeast has declined considerably in recent years. So there aren't many of them, but as Peter King, a Republican from New York, pointed out yesterday, many Republicans from other parts of the country still come to New York and New Jersey to raise campaign funds, and he actually urged those people to stop giving money. So I think you are seeing a little bit of regionalism in the response to Sandy, that those mm-hmm. tend to be states that perform Democratic in presidential elections and increasingly so in congressional elections.
Yeah, Peter was pretty upset yesterday, wasn't he?
He was indeed.
Ooh. Well, thank you, Jason, so much for being with us this hour. It was a lively hour. I had a lot of interest, and thank you for your expertise.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Jason Roberts, our guest for a look at the 213th Congress. and I mean the 113th Congress, I got ahead of myself, and the end of the 112th Congress, we thank Rhonda Fanning, who produces this program. Thank you, Rhonda, and thanks for all of your calls. Jason is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Previously, he's got Midwestern sensibilities. He was at the University of Minnesota. Stay tuned. The author of Far From the Tree, Andrew Solomon, will be joining us.